welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 4.8. While there is plenty to discuss, we're lying if we tell you we're thinking about anything other than this Saturday at noon.
It's Ohio State Week, and if you listen to this podcast long enough, you will hear plenty of Ohio State talk from Alex and I. But one thing we did not include in that timing was your best Ohio State in-person story.
I only have a few Ohio State in-person stories, but
you, supposedly you have a great one.
I don't know. It's an okay one.
Don't sell it then. So guys, skip forward about two minutes.
So in 2018, I was calling the game between Michigan and Ohio State in Columbus for WCBN Sports from the photo deck, which is where we often did it. But anyway, the game obviously is at noon. So we were driving down the day of the game. So we woke up at 5:45 a.m. and just got right in the car, picked the other people up, and then we drove down. You know, it's about a 3 hour or so drive, got into Columbus, found the way to the stadium, got to the photo deck, got everything set up around 9:45 or 10, which, by the way, I do not recommend waking up at 6 a.m. on the day of an Ohio State game.
I mean, that's when you have to go.
Well, so the joy about not going to the games, like I will not be doing on Saturday, is waking up at like 11:45 and then the game's just starting. So there's no time to think about the stakes or anything. You just wake up and now it's on. Whereas for that, the whole ride down, you know, you're just driving and then you're just looking out the window and just staring at Urban Meyer in your head the entire time. But anyway, we get there and set everything up. And now we've got like an hour or an hour and a half. And so we're like, well, what do we do? Well, we had access to the field for some reason. A lot of places I went with credentials never gave me.
Usually you do.
We rarely did.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of places, since we weren't photographers and we didn't have a sideline reporter, we didn't use.
I guess for that game, I could see it, yeah.
But we did for this. So we went down the elevator and went down to the field and just kind of hung out there. And we were in the like corner of the end zone and watched. The Michigan players were right in front of us warming up. And remember, for that game, everyone got their binoculars on to track Chase Winovich's every move after the Indiana game to see if he was warming up, and he was. And I remember the wide receivers were doing their drills right in front of us, and so it was kind of interesting in that way. And then we ran into a few people. That we ran into Isaiah Hole down there. We ran into Brad Galley from ABC, you know, WXYZ Detroit. He gave me his business card, and you know, we just kind of walked around. It was an interesting experience and stuff. And then,
wait, did you ask for it, or is he just going around handing out his cards?
Yeah,
he's just going around me like, "Hey, I'm Brad Galley. Hey, I'm Brad Galley. Hey, check me out, I'm Brad Galley."
I still have it in my wallet, but I'd have to check. Anyway, it was an interesting time. And then the time starts ticking down. It's about 35 minutes or so before the kickoff. So once the band is getting ready to come on and the players have gone to the locker room, we decide we're going to head up. So we go to where the stairs are to go back up to the concourse and then to the elevator. Well, it turns out there's only one way on the field and one way off, a single staircase. And
stairs?
Yeah. Jeez. And so it also turns out that since this is the game, Ohio State is using this as their recruiting showcase, which means that alongside us on the field before the game has been literally every recruit that Ohio State will be talking to over the next 2.5 years, and all of their parents, grandmas, aunts, uncles, cousins, you know,
700 people.
It's just an unfathomable amount of people who all of whom have lined up and are waiting single file to go up the stairs to the concourse and to then, you know, find their seats or whatever. So we see this line forming, and the stairs, mind you, are at roughly midfield, and we're like, oh, we have to go to the back of the line. We start walking. The line is 35 yards. We walked all the way to the red zone to get in the back of this line, and we stand there for about 5 minutes and suddenly are thinking, this isn't moving very quickly. this is bad.
And I don't know if you know anything about crowds, but they generally don't move quickly at games.
Upstairs,
everyone just kind of like stands and stares and looks around. Yeah.
And so we're standing there, and it's not moving very fast. And over the period of about the next 15 minutes, you just keep pulling out your phone every 2 minutes, and now it's 11:38. Now it's 11:40. Now it's 11:42, and you're still not really all that close to the stairs, and you're just thinking, this is bad. We need to be back where our stuff is. Now, the good news is we had left behind a designated survivor, you know, in case we had been murdered on the field or something. So we had one
that's
person.
That's the problem.
We had one person up in, you know, the photo deck. So we were texting him and saying, we're probably not getting off this field in time.
It's about to be you, guy.
So you're going to have to start the broadcast solo. And he was supposed to do the second half, too. So we are communicated with him. Well, anyway, I was supposed to do the first half. And so the crowd is still not really moving. Now it's 11:45, 11:47, and we're still not really all that close. So what I decide to do is, and mind you, the two people I was with, one is probably 5'10", the other one's maybe 6'1". But I sort of realize, okay, I know what I can do here. This is the moment I was made for. And decide I'm just going to fit my way between people and casually just sort of weave my way up to the stairs. And so, you know, just kind of, oh, you know, like this, and just sort of nudge people out of the way and just weasel my way between people all the way up to the stairs, and managed to get up to the stairs at about 11:57. And then I charge up the staircase and get to the concourse about 11:59 or noon. And the band is just exiting the field for the coin toss. And then I got into the elevator at the time of the coin toss, got up to the photo deck, sprinted across the photo deck, and then put on the headset as the kickoff was happening.
Did you say, and we're live from Columbus, Ohio?
No, but it was... So the story, the reason that's an intriguing story, besides me weaponizing my height, is... that my memory of that game is really colored by that experience, because when I put the headset on, my heart is just pounding because I've been stressed the whole time about not getting up in time for the game. And so when I put the headset on, I was already in like a bad mental place. And so the moment Michigan punts for the first time to begin that game, I'm like, this is over. We've lost. And so
did you say that on the air?
No, but that's my memory of my memory too. Like after the Olave touchdown, is the game is totally over. And so whenever I rewatch the highlights, like I did last night, I'm always stunned that Michigan was down like 7-6 with the ball in the second quarter. I'm like, no, the game was over from the first drive.
Right.
And apparently
they scored,
it wasn't.
They got 50 points on the first play. Yeah. You're like,
but my memory is just. And also, it was so exhausting, too, because that first half is bonkers. There's like 40 points scored, including about 20 in the final 2 minutes of play between Michigan's touchdown, Michigan's other touchdown after the kickoff fumble.
Yeah, I was about to say.
2-point and don't get it. And then Ohio State in about 60 seconds drives 80 yards and runs 4 plays at the goal line, you know, before they have to kick the field goal. And so there was so much in that first half, in addition to the stress and crowd debacle on the field, that when I took off the headset, I was just like, I am done. Just like mentally, I know the game's not over, but I have nothing left to give this game.
with the day.
It was
passing out under the table.
And the victory Culvers we had planned in Dublin, Ohio became sad Culvers. So
at least you got Culvers. That's like one of your favorite things.
So that's the story. Never go on the field before you have responsibilities within an hour.
Well, at least when there are 400 recruits in there at the stadium anyway.
So you can go on the field against Rutgers, just not against Ohio State.
Well, we didn't quite need sad Culvers this weekend, but we needed sad, kind of sad, a little bit sad something.
So here's how I'll set the stage.
All right.
I am more angry than last year's sweep at Notre Dame or against Notre Dame.
Well,
but
sure.
It was actually measurably better because the losses really didn't mean all that much in the long run. They got 0.9 wins on the weekend for pairwise purposes. And so the impact is very blunted compared to last year. Yet I am substantially angrier.
I mean, Unless they go, I mean, this is starting to, we're doing the end of the podcast first, but unless they go in the tank, which I should not theoretically happen, I mean, they're gonna be a pretty good pairwise. They're gonna have a good pairwise ranking just because of what they've already done, and you assume they're gonna win more games this year. The thing that I want is, I mean, I want to win the Big Ten regular season. I want to
Which they're
hang
still in
that,
first in
yes,
point
but I want to
percentage,
hang that
so
banner, but also I want to
shrug.
everything should. I want everything to come through Yoast. So, anyway. So, yeah, it wasn't the weekend that we'd hoped for. It was the weekend that we sort of emotionally planned for during the podcast last week because this is what happens. I mean,
Not really,
I looked
though.
this up. Huh? Well, we said, like,
Because,
this is what happens when you face Notre Dame.
well, sure, but what I think is the tough part about this weekend is that they were not classic Notre Dame games.
Yeah.
Michigan gets multi-goal leads in both games. Like
Yeah.
the Notre Dame game is what happened last year. We're like, oh, it
Yeah.
bounces off the crossbar and in, and now you're down 1-0, and the game just grinds to a halt. That's not what this was. This was
No.
we got them where we want them, and then we stepped on an upturned
They are
grade.
who we thought they were,
Yeah.
and we let them off the hook. Yeah, well, I mean, that's essentially what happened. The first period of the Friday game, as we try to start this, I kind of called this as like the Holt's roller coaster period because we just talked about him like an hour before on the Friday radio show, and he'd played pretty well, I think, in the previous few games, at least to the point of where he didn't do anything too egregious. Of course, he was also playing Michigan State and Penn State, but he had some issues connecting some passes, getting the puck out of the zone. He was on a shift with Summers at one point where I was just like trying to, like, you can't. So the press box at Yoast is pretty forgiving for whatever you really want to do, honestly. I mean, let's be real.
It's not really a
But
press box. It's just kind of,
the rafters at
yeah.
Yoast where you're hanging from the steel beams is pretty forgiving for the most part. But you're like, you don't, you know, there are certain rules. Okay, you know, if you're cheering, you laugh instead of cheer because, you know, you're allowed to laugh. Anyway, so you're trying not to like respond, but I'm sitting there watching Holtz and Summers just like flail around on the one shift, and you're like, oh gosh, like somebody freeze the pucks. I hope it hits like the mesh or something. Like we just need to get a change, and we couldn't. It was an interesting start, especially after like then also Truscott gets like smoked down the wing, and Portillo has to flash the leather very early and keep it a scoreless game like a couple minutes in.
Yeah, Holtz. It was interesting because we had just been on the Friday show not
Right.
long before that, and Brian was really talking up Steve Holtz, which made me very uncomfortable internally. But then I felt kind of vindicated by that period because his performance was very indicative of sort of what my roadmap of him was, which is like, this is a big stiff who can do a few things, but you don't really want handling the puck on breakouts, and probably is not one of the eight best defensemen on this team.
And then out of nowhere, Owen Power has the puck near the top of the house and just completely gaffes and fumbles it in the offensive zone. And it's a breakaway the other way. And you're like, oh, come on. First of all the guys. And secondly, you're just like, oh, no, this can't, like, this is how this game goes poorly. And Steve Holtz, like, sucks down his diesel jet fuel and just motors down the ice at a speed I don't know if you've ever skated before and just plows the guy so that not only does the guy not get a shot, I don't even count it as a breakaway, but he doesn't even make like the slot. Like he runs him down almost pre-house on the ice. And you were like mentioned to me, like, I have to go back and rewatch that because maybe the guy like turned the wrong way or like started fading or something. But like Steve Holtz actually then makes one of the better plays he's made in a Michigan uniform.
That was a very heroic play, I'll say that, because it was just shocking, right? Just of Steve Holtz, of all the people, right? Not Hughes or Edwards or Blankenberg or, you know, a defenseman that has sort of that skill set that you would expect to get on their horse and really run a guy down. But that was a wild play.
Yeah. And that was mostly it, I think, for the first period. It wasn't uneventful as some things definitely happened, but there were no real goals. There were no power plays. It was some events you don't normally see. But then into the second period, still 0-0. It gets a little sloppy for Michigan. The sloppiness kind of kicks in a little bit early. Edwards has a bad defensive turnover that Portillo makes a big save on. Notre Dame gets a chance that goes wide when Truscott misses a clear. And then Landon Slygert. So there's two Slygerts, right? There's Landon, who I think is the higher drafted one, and then Graham is
there's two of them.
Brock Caulfield, right, for this.
Brent Gretzky.
Yeah, there you go. He gets Landon, the good slagger, gets a breakaway, but his shot goes wide. Notre Dame gets a power play. But Michigan on the weekend, I thought, actually did pretty well on the penalty kill. One of the few things they really did well. But in this case, they don't really get anything. There was a rebound. One shot, I think, that Portillo left a big rebound. Hughes flew right in, cleared it away, nothing else. And then they get a 2-on-1 that Beniers kind of comes back and helps save. So they're living dangerously, but still at 0-0. Not the greatest, probably, first 12, 15 minutes of the second period.
Yeah, I do agree about the penalty killing thing. You know, their only issues shorthanded this weekend were on 4-on-3s, which are very different scenarios.
That's not. I mean, it's a penalty.
Or 5-on-3s for like a full 2 minutes. So,
also not what we're talking about. And then after, there's another defensive turnover from Bortolo. And then you get the second pick in the NHL draft from last year decides to just flash all of his skill. And Matty Beniers just goes coast to coast through, I'm guessing, every guy on the ice, maybe some of them twice, and finally gets to the crease and just can't get like his stick on the puck after he's moved everyone, including the goalie Ryan Bischel, who was in because Galida, I guess, didn't make the trip for whatever reason. We never really got clarification on that, but he moves Bischel, gets through everybody, and just can't get the puck on a stick to finish. But Brendan Brisson is right there, slams home the rebound. It's 1-0. We don't give up the first goal to the Siege Layers, and you get sort of that lead against Notre Dame at Yost, something they hadn't had in quite a while.
I mean, you're feeling pretty good when that happens. So I will say, from Notre Dame's perspective, if we're sort of grading who is the culprit here, it's Burke and Silanoff, who are both just watching the play and not picking up Brisson, who follows it up. The defenseman gets undressed by Beniers, but he isn't able to finish. And there's two blue jerseys that Brisson just skates right by, and they're not doing anything about him. They don't pick him up, and he's right there to put it in. So a little bit of puck watching from Notre Dame, and Brisson is in position, which is what you want, and then you get the goal.
This also happened about 5 to 10 seconds after you texted me, rage texting me about where is Matty Beniers and Kent Johnson and Brendan Brisson all game.
What's notable about that we didn't talk about is that Mel fired up the blender again, and as a result came up with this kind of superpower first line,
right,
where you have Brisson, Beniers, and Kent Johnson together. And so if you're doing that, right, if you're going to make Thomas Bortolo carry 40 pounds of weight on his back by hauling that second line and then put everybody together on the first line, that line better show up. And through about 40 minutes, they weren't. So it was good that they did.
And the other thing that happened too is like that has happened, and this is kind of indicative a little bit of the weekend, maybe not as much a Saturday game, but at least a Friday game, where, you know, these super talented lines for Michigan don't always show up on a shift to shift basis. They, like, you can see their skill and ability just pop every once in a while, and you get these like NHL plays where you're like, oh, look, we just got McDavid for a shift. But then like the next two or three shifts, it's very even or negative sometimes, or maybe a little bit of positive, but it's like they're playing right around the level of whoever they're playing against. And then all of a sudden a switch gets flipped and you see this, like I said, this Beniers play. And he's honestly, like you talk about Matty Beniers, the last two or three weeks, it hasn't been close. He's been Michigan's best player.
Yep.
So that is a little concerning that we'll get into probably a little bit later on some of our takeaways, but going into the third period, Michigan's up 1-0. You're like, you know, this is good, especially if they get another one. Like, we could be in some really big happy feelings. Also, going into the third period, Michigan still hasn't had a power play. So
we have to decide when we're going to talk about refereeing for the
that's going to
weekend.
be the second segment. There's going to be we're not as going to talk about as much game, I think, but there's two or three things. One's going to be Portillo, one's going to be the power play, one's going to be refereeing, whatever. So they get their first chance and it goes terribly for like the first minute 40 or something, and then you get three NHL passes, one or well, three NHL plays, two passes, one from Power to Brisson, one from Brisson to Beniers, and then Beniers just snipes the inside of the far post. It's and then in the net, obviously it's 2-0 off of this really nice play again, out of nowhere after the entire minute 40 or whatever is them just trying to figure out if they can even enter the zone, and
So
then you just get this. Go ahead.
I'd like to point out that I was right here because I was on the Friday show maybe 2 weeks ago. I think it was just me and Seth before the Penn State series, and we were talking about Beniers suddenly becoming the ultimate power play weapon. And I said putting him and Brisson on the same power play with both on the two wings would be very effective because, as we talked about in the summer, the 1-3-1 power play works the best when you have shooters and passers on both sides, where both guys can do both. And I said that with the way Brisson had grown as a passer, you could get away with him as that. And what happens? It's Brisson to Beniers, changes sides pass for the goal.
And then, I mean, we're thinking, I didn't want to tweet that this is over because you just don't do that. But like, I mean, were you thinking that? Because I was thinking that. Like, be honest. I don't believe you anyway.
Maybe. I mean, the
So,
next goal happened so quickly, you didn't really have a
well,
lot of
that's
time to think
true.
about it.
That's true. And so it's two, while you're still tweeting this out and taking notes and being like, whoa, holy cow, here we go. Like the puck ends up in the back of the net. And this is one for you that you kind of broken down, but it ended up where Michigan got kind of all their guys on one side. Blankenberg had kind of two guys in front, left one to take the other, and the guy he left ended up getting a backdoor pass that was just a dunk. I mean, it was there's nothing Portillo could do with it, Portillo could do with it, but I mean, it you know, you get bad bounce goals and stuff. But this wasn't really one of them. This is where you put Blankenberg in a position where somebody should have been taking the guy in his right so that he could stick the guy in his left and it wasn't a tap and goal.
Yeah, well, so what happens here, it was a little tough to tell because the whole possession was obstructed by them showing us a huge close-up of Matty Beniers' face on the BTN because they only show us the Jumbotron. And so the Jumbotron
BTN
announces the
minus.
goal. And so we get to see the big,
Yeah.
face image and while the play is
Face.
going on. But what you basically happen at early in the play is all five Michigan defenders are on the same side. And then as a result, you've got the point man for Notre Dame. I believe it was Lieberman. He's got the puck on the left point, and so you've got a forward sliding down the right side. Duke and Edwards are both sort of on the same side. They're a little late to pick that up. The puck cycles low to high from the corner up top. They make the diagonal pass. It doesn't hit tape to tape, but the real culprit here to me is Jimmy Lambert, because when the puck goes low to high, Lambert goes also high, and Morgan is already sort of accounting for the point man. And so, if you break it down, when the puck is low, there are three Michigan defenders and three Notre Dame defenders. Yet, after the puck goes high and then the diagonal pass is made, suddenly there's three Notre Dame guys and two Michigan guys. And the one guy who wandered away was Lambert, paying attention, basically chasing the puck like a, like a child in soccer, like a 5-year-old, right? Just
Beehive soccer, beehive hockey.
following the puck to a guy who was already covered. You've got a numbers problem down low, and then it puts Blankenberg in a very tough situation in front where there's two guys and he has to cover both of them. He reads it very poorly. I mean, he's going to the wrong guy while it's like very clear through body language which guy the puck is going to. So he's not totally off the hook, but he should not have been in that position. You've got to have the numbers battle accounted for. And so it's just kind of a team-wide breakdown there.
Yeah, something that was a little too familiar over the course of the weekend. And it's not that every goal was like that, but there were a lot of chances in this game where, Norton could have had a lot more goals. I mean, Portillo played really, really well in that Friday game. He made a number of other saves, a lot with his glove, which I thought was an impressive thing from him. Not that he hasn't used it before, but it seemed more noticeable this weekend where he made a lot of high saves with his glove. They looked like they were trying to go high. He's obviously been a great positional goalie. Last week we talked about he's made some acrobatic saves with his kick saves and his pads and getting out and doing sort of the Strauss man thing. This week I thought he was great with his glove, at least on Friday anyway. He had a couple more saves as the period progressed. He had a great one where he stuck his back leg to the post. I don't know if you remember this, but he's out in front, makes a save. The puck it looks like it's going to get jammed in, and he just like throws his skate against the post and somehow
Yeah,
like keeps it out.
I think that's one of them I sent you for the screenshot of what's wrong with
Okay.
this picture
Yeah. But it
right
was that was
before it occurred.
so he's hanging on for dear life, trying to keep Michigan's lead. Van Wy gets another couple chances at the other end, doesn't really go in. And then it just kind of like starts to splinter because Portillo like makes a number of big saves, like two or three in a row. And then he thinks he kind of has it covered. It's like, looks like it's maybe under him, and it just sort of gets poked through him, past him, something. It was far side, harder to see. There was a big sort of scrum,
Yeah,
and it just kind of leaked in. It's hard to put that on him, but.
this play is a lot of things go wrong. I had to rewatch it about 15 times to get a sense of really what is happening here. But Michigan tries to break it out. They don't connect to pass. Pastajov, I think, is trying to get Bortolo, but we'll never know because of the camera angle. And the pass was good. I just think that whoever it was trying to receive it just didn't recognize it. So Notre Dame intercepted in the neutral zone. They dump it back in. Notre Dame goes for a change, I believe. And then the puck, Holtz goes after it. Actually, no, they don't go. I don't know if there was a change, but there's one forechecker down there. Holtz grabs it. He ladles it along to Power. And then Power does a reverse rim that normally you kind of make if you think there's going to be a guy there. So, like a defenseman will see the forward coming at them, the forechecking forward, and they'll look him down, and then they'll just do a backhand reverse no-look rim around to the far side. You see that a lot in D to D rims in those situations to alleviate pressure. But this is a D to F rim, and he knows it's that because he sees Holtz right in front of him. But there's no forward on that side. And so the puck just rims around to about the half wall, but there's nobody there. So the Notre Dame guy comes down, picks it up, shoots from a very bad angle, and Portillo is right against the cage. It's not a hard shot. That's what the one thing I would fault Portillo on here is that shot produces like a kind of big rebound, not a huge rebound, but probably it seemed light enough of a shot that he frankly could have just covered it.
Or
And
control a
instead
little
he
better.
Yeah, instead, he just lets it bounce off his pads. And then there's just kind of a debacle going on where Holtz doesn't really tie up his guy. Power doesn't really assert his presence in front. Morgan was the one who went to find the Notre Dame guy who took the shot. He's late getting back because the Notre Dame guy who takes the shot follows his own rebound, and Morgan's chasing him from behind. And so there's just kind of three bodies in front for both teams. So six total plus Portillo. And it's just kind of guys whacking away, and then it sort of goes in. And there's just a lot of stuff that's kind of weird on this play, but it's tough to tell how it went in. We never saw the above angle, which I would have wanted to see, the crease from above to see who actually got it and how it went in. But it's just kind of a mess. And that one actually isn't, I think, the most distressing of all of the things that happened in the last 10 minutes, because sort of sandwiching that are two different ones I sent you, just screenshots of a Notre Dame guy in front of the net all alone, and Michigan players just not paying attention to that. I mean, one of them is Garrett Van Wy, which just really frustrates me when he's a defensive guy and he sees a blue sweater in front of the net with no one around him and he's drifting away from the play. And so there's several of these plays where Notre Dame wins the board battle, and then sure enough, have a dude in front of the net at point blank range wide open, and Portillo stones him several times. And it's just like the last 10 minutes of that period is just a total catastrophe in terms of in zone defensive coverage, just not recognizing who is supposed to be doing what who's supposed to be getting who, all that sort of stuff.
And the bummer about it is, like, I mean, Michigan, granted, the lead lasted about 40 seconds or a minute or whatever it was, but, you know, they have a 2-goal lead here against a team that does score some goals, but isn't known for being them or Minnesota or some, like, outlandish scoring huge threat. And you'd think at a certain point, it's like, all right, I don't want to see a bunch of Michigan State hockey, but if you have a 2-goal lead against a good team at home, like, this is the time when you better get your defensive assignments right. You don't have to turtle all the time, but you better know where you're going. And that's sort of what changed around Michigan's year in years past, whereas when they could get leads and then they could protect them. And that's something that we've seen a couple of times this year, at least this weekend. You know, it wasn't just the goals, right? It wasn't just, oh, they gave up a goal and something went wrong. It happened, like you said. You had sent screenshots before and after where it happened again and again and again. So this is like a repetitive pattern.
Michigan was very, very lucky to get to overtime in a game. Yeah. They led 2-0 with 15 minutes to go, which yikes.
Yeah. So talking about overtime, it's 2-2 going to overtime. We can talk about this after we talk through what happens. I'd like to get your thoughts on it. But so I thought Bortolo took kind of a bad shot early on, and he was on the ice for a while, took kind of a shot that wasn't really going to go anywhere anyway. And then that led to Portillo having to make two really big saves at the other end in sort of a rush situation. And then
that's overtime. That's 3-on-3.
Well, yeah. And that's why we're going to talk about this in a second. But then you get the situation where Garrett Van Wy hits a guy in the corner and gets a 5-minute major for the second time in like 4 or 5 games.
And that one was pretty legit. It wasn't like an awful malicious hit, but at the end of the day, you cross check a guy in the back who's standing up. He goes into the boards face first. You know what's going to happen. Like, just end of story.
And now he's getting a bit of a reputation for it. I mean, he's had those in the past. My question is, in 3-on-3 hockey, why is Garrett Van Wy on the ice? In this team. Not last year. Not 2 years ago.
Yeah, this is not a team where you have to kind of go down the depth chart to find guys. Like,
I mean, if you want to play two defensemen like Truscott and Hughes, that's fine.
Generally, you do short shifts in overtime in 3-on-3 because there's so much skating inherent to it.
Yeah.
But you have enough guys to short shift and be fine. Like, yeah. I will list all of the forwards who should be playing ahead of Garrett Van Wy, right? Samoskevich, Beecher, Bortolo, Brisson, Paniers, Kent Johnson, Dylan Duke, Luke Morgan. That's 8 right there. Probably Jimmy Lambert.
You don't need 8, right? In these situations. I mean, very rarely. Because you're going to use a guy later.
Yeah.
The guy who takes the first shift is going to take the third or the fourth shift.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't understand it at all. I mean, also, if you want to put Garrett Van Wy out there to start the overtime for the face-off, I guess, okay. But he was out there with like 2 minutes to go.
He was the third or fourth shift.
What is going on?
So they get the power play. There's like 2 minutes to go. It's going to last till the end. So it's doesn't really matter how long. I think it was 140 something. And it's a 4-on-3. And Ralston just has a blast from one of the dots that beats Portillo.
At that point, you're just in a situation where it's like, well, we'll either get to a shootout because Portillo saves us or we won't. Because a 4-on-3 overtime or 4-on-3 power play is dangerous. I mean, the Gretzky rule was a thing for a reason. Like, those power plays are just lethal.
So now we come to what I wanted to talk to you about, and because I have an idea of this, but how you play 3-on-3 overtime. So after getting to watch it 2 games in a row and seeing a lot of it, my thought, I want to see if you agree with me, is you're basically just keeping possession. And you're skating around until you get the look that you want. And if you don't get it, then you pass it out of the zone to your goalie or you skate it back out or whatever. But the last thing that you want to do in 3-on-3 overtime is take anything that isn't a really good shot.
Well, I'll tell you how I would want to see overtime just as a fan. There was...
Okay.
There was an overtime
Tell us what you think about Monkey. He's an apes too.
Yeah.
This is terrible podcasting.
There was an overtime like a month ago between the Rangers and the Maple Leafs that I was watching, and it was just pure craziness. I mean, just trading breakaways at both ends. One goalie makes a sprawling save. They pick the puck up. It's 2-on-1 the other way. That is what 3-on-3 was invented to be. That's what it was.
Right. And it gets people fired. So people realize, let's not do this. We need to, like, not just have this be an odd man rush show.
I mean, if I'm Michigan, I would honestly want it to be an odd man rush show, because I take my shooters and my goalie over your shooters and your goalie.
And Portillo has been, I wrote about this, I think, on Saturday. He's kind of been like money in really bad situations.
Yeah, like, that's how I would play it. If you're Notre Dame, yeah, you want to play the hot potato battle. But if you're Michigan, honestly, I'd want to just go crazy. From that standpoint, see if I can't get something wild to happen. I don't know.
Well, you kind of need the other team.
I'm not too into 3-on-3 strategy too much. You know, a lot of my background is more NHL strategy, and no one practices it in the NHL because it's a weird thing that you do like 8 times a season, and then it doesn't matter when your season's on the line in the playoffs. So
that's
who really cares.
True. All right. Well, we won't.
Overtime here meant 1/10 of a win.
Well, okay, but I wasn't really talking about that. I was talking more about,
I'm just
like,
telling
extra,
you, for pairwise purposes. Yeah, for pairwise purposes.
But I'm talking about
that,
but
goal
it does
was
mean,
worth 1/10 of a win.
But given what Minnesota did, spoiler alert, that 1 point would have been nice to have.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458. Or visit his website at MichiganLawGrad.com.
Much like the Penn State series last week, or whenever you're listening to this, potentially almost 2 weeks ago at this point, Michigan basically plays the same game twice in sort of different fashions. This one starts actually pretty well for Michigan on Saturday, and that was really good to see, because after coming off a game where you have a third period collapse and lose in overtime in a game that, yeah, we talk about how many chances there were, that they could have lost it. They weren't really in that situation for the whole game, and they could have very easily won it. I don't think there are hockey like win percentage graphs anywhere. That would be interesting to see.
Well, there's the deserve to win-o-meter on Moneypuck.com.
No, I just meant like,
but that's
you
not...
know, the one over time where it goes up and down.
Yeah,
for football.
ESPN.
And,
yeah,
yeah,
no.
Okay.
Moneypuck has an expected goals tracker thing that's like that.
Okay.
But it's not that.
So,
and also there are no expected goals in NCAA. So
no,
the Wild West.
I would love it if there were. That would change
very
a
nice.
Lot of the, yes. So if someone wants to do that,
it
you
would
have
require
our
having cameras that watch that like give us usable footage of the games,
which is right out in these situations. So after having a rough end to the Friday game, Michigan bounces back pretty well. They actually go up 2 in the first period. Portillo makes a couple of big saves early on to get them to that point. Notre Dame gets a power play that is kind of dangerous, but they don't really get many opportunities on net. And because Michigan draws a call, so both teams actually in that sense get one. There's some 4-on-4 in between. Not a whole lot happens. And then you texted me, "Hello, Mackie," as Samuskevich makes a really nice play to get free in the slot and, of course, hits the post, because as would happen in this series. But Mike Pasta, who has kind of been inconspicuous for the last month or so, he started okay, and he comes flying in for the slot, slams home the rebound. It's 1-0, and you're like, all right, we definitely need the first goal tonight, and they got it.
Yeah, well, this is the Samoskovich game. Because the second goal is Samo as well. Turns on the Jets, speed and skill right through two guys and creates a 2-on-1 out of thin air, basically, with Steve Holtz jumping up and then his shot is saved, but Bortolo puts it in. I mean, both of those goals are very, very similar goals. I'll note on the first one, Notre Dame finally gets hit with bad end zone defensive coverage because they've got five guys and they just collapse and give him way too much space. And he comes from out of the corner and is able to walk through the dot to the slot and get a shot of white with no obstruction and just rips it right off the iron. I mean, that is not a shot you can be giving up when he was in the corner just like 3 seconds ago.
And that is not something that happened very much at all in either game. I mean, Michigan was not just waltzing in there.
Yeah, and I also say that Samo, I mean, his shot is in the conversation for the third best on the team, maybe the second. I don't know. It's in that. We've seen it a few times. It is a rocket.
Well, and he has like snipes too. It's not like it's a blast. Like you've seen guys get
teed up. It's not Jacob Triscott.
Right. But I mean, we're talking about like Brisson and Beecher and Beniers have all like scored goals from that dot. This, I mean, he's had these like sniper looks, these laser shots from different from tougher angles too.
Yeah.
So I agree with that. So again, it's 2-0. You're like, all right, this is it. It's going to happen. I was not thinking in my head the game is over this time. There's way too much game to be playing. But within, again, like a minute or so later, within a couple minutes.
I was about to tweet, well, if you wanted to see a good response from Michigan after last night's tough
you've loss. You've just seen it.
And then
you had to delete it.
About 102 characters in or something.
So but you this can one walk us through. Yeah, walk
this
us through
one's
this
a
one.
Weird one because it's a 2-on-3 that Notre Dame comes in on. Not particularly dangerous. They have a trailer. But like what's tough about this is that none of the goals Michigan gives up in this game, I think, are particularly poor end zone coverage. I mean, like just looking back and rewatching the tape, it tends to be more really bad bounces and then that like negative 3 goal save above expected game from Portillo that you knew was coming. Because he's been saving a lot more goals than expected the whole season. And so you've got Michigan playing good fundamental defense, getting back on the back check. There's someone, a 20 number, could be several guys, but we'll never know. There's no way to find out.
It's not Moyle.
Is right there and is lifting the stick of the Notre Dame guy from behind, exactly what you want. And then the puck goes off his sort of skate and then bounces off a guy and then goes right to another Notre Dame player who doesn't get a very good shot away that just kind of slingshots towards the net on the ice level. And then Portillo just doesn't get the pad across.
And it's down. It's just not on the ice. Like he's down where he's in the position where you want his leg to be. It's just not flush with the ice. So it just goes right underneath it because it was right in front of where I was sitting. And so you just see the puck as it's on the ice, just kind of do that little curlicue, like around the back of the net as it comes through. So it wasn't like bouncing and shooting. And if he has his puck on the ice, it's harmlessly directed in the corner. Like he just literally follows the path of his pad and just is in the corner and you're, you know, out of danger at that particular time, but he just, and that hasn't happened a whole lot for him. I mean, it will later in the game, but looking back at the year, if you could count the bad goals he'd given up before that particular one, I mean, it's probably like 3, maybe.
Probably something in that range.
Yeah. So, you know, you can be, I was frustrated at the time, but at the same time, I'm going to be like, what are you going to do? Get mad at the one time he screws up? I mean, we did not know that later on in the game, he would do a couple other things, but it's 2-1 and it's just, and it was right at the end of the period. So they go into the period after having a really nice period, getting 2 goals, getting the lead, bouncing back from the ridiculousness of Friday. And then they give up 1 and Notre Dame feels like energetic. They're flying into their locker room. Michigan's just kind of like, it was there. We had it. And it was all just starting to fall apart because pretty soon into the second period, this one, not Portillo's fault, a shot, I believe that came from the right point, hits something, someone in front, right to an unchecked Lansdowne. Now I will say that, you know, he was unchecked. So
yeah, I thought about going back and trying to figure out what's going on with the end zone coverage, but at the same time, it's just such a comical bounce that
yeah.
I mean, the shot comes in and just does a straight beeline off a skate right to his, I mean, right to the tape. And
like Portillo's, it was planned.
Like it's just, what are you going to do?
And it's 2-2. So all of that work was pretty much undone there. And it feels like, all right, if you look at it and you think, okay, they're getting chances and they can, they've scored a couple goals. So, and Bischel, I thought the second goal was like, we kind of zoomed past it a little bit, but the one that Bordalo got off of the Samo, nice play. He thought he had it and he just,
yeah, that was not great.
Right. So it, this Bischel played really well on Friday. We didn't get into that as much. He did not play as well on Saturday. So
he played pretty well, thinking, except for when he didn't. I mean, he made a lot of saves in the late third period, but
okay. But he did give up a couple goals that you wouldn't really expect.
Sure.
And this, and so it's in your mind, you're not thinking we're facing, you know, Patrick Waugh here or something, or at least one of his good games. But then it, then the game gets weird because Portillo goes behind the net to play the puck, something that, you know, Michigan fans have not seen a lot of out of goalies. So they're very, what's the word? Like, opinionated on, I guess. Like, some people have very strong, like, don't ever do that, and other people are like, hey, finally, well, a goalie's
not
gonna
just
play
a
the
Michigan thing, that's an everyone who watches hockey thing.
It's a hockey thing.
Yeah,
well, it's newish, newer for Michigan fans at this particular time. I'm generally on team play the puck. If you can play it and you can skate and you know what you're doing, you're only an asset to your team. You're gonna have a screw up, but so is everyone on the team and so is everyone on the ice, so, you know, I can deal with it. So he goes behind the net, plays the puck, and is you said probably a little bit late getting there, and a Max Ellis, probably the best player on Notre Dame, or at least so far this year, kind of comes down to forecheck him, and Portillo just clears it right into him.
There's,
and Ellis just sort of catches it and carries it around and drops it in the open net.
There's a few things that could have done differently on that play, and I'm not sure which ones would have, you know, led to the proper result. One option is him to get there a lot quicker because he kind of takes his time, even as a Notre Dame guy is flying down the wing. The other option, once he's in that position and he sees the player in front of him, is to go backwards, right, to do the reverse rim the other way, what Power did in the previous day.
Yeah.
But, you know, instead, he just decides to go right through with it. And it's just one of those things that you watch happening and you're just like, oh no, as it is happening live. And then he does the exact same thing you're envisioning. And then, yep, there we are. That's kind of the situation.
It's 3-2. And this is already not Portillo's best game. He gives up one more that is not awesome either later on. But before we get there, you know, it feels like Michigan has gotten very few power plays, probably because they hadn't, and they needed one. And they get one, they get a couple of shots early in it, and then they get another power play on top of it. So it's a 5-on-3, and you're like, all right, this has to be a goal, and maybe two, and it just needs to get everybody going again, because you're up 2-0, and you're Notre Dame, and you're playing against Notre Dame. We've been down this road. They need a spark. And they get their 5-on-3. And now this has been a thing for a few years that has haunted sort of the Mel power plays. But this was one of the worst 5-on-3 power plays I've seen. Not just this one, but they get a 5-on-3 later. And it just looks like they have no plan for a 5-on-3. They think it's a 5-on-4, but with one fewer people, one fewer person on the ice. And that's not what a 5-on-3 is.
Nope. And they don't get the looks you want, so
they don't even really try. The thing that I was most frustrated about is that it just looked like they didn't know what to do, and they'd get guys at the point, like Kent, I think one was Kent Johnson, one was Brendan Brisson, and they'd get the puck deep at the point where Irish guys are all packed pretty much in that, definitely in the house and mostly in the slot, and there's no reason to be standing that far away, especially on a 5-on-3. And then they get these running skates, running starts, as you just come like flying in, and then Brisson is there and he doesn't know where to go because, I mean, no one else knows what he's doing, and he may not even. And all of a sudden then he's behind the net, or the puck goes behind the net, and they have to dig it out again. And like the 30 or 40 seconds goes by really, really fast because they pass it around, not even in any like threatening manner, but also no one is in the middle. Like, shouldn't someone be in the middle or in front of the goalie?
Yeah, just I have to go back and really look at the way that they went about it, but what was not a terribly coherent 5-on-3, and it was at a moment where you felt like you needed goals. But thankfully, they get two more in the game that are both gifted to them by Notre Dame. So
Right.
what
The
goes
next
around
one.
comes around or something.
Well, speaking of going around, that is how they got their third goal, as Dylan Duke gets the puck near the net and goes
Which is
around.
another bad D zone coverage where Notre Dame, he's all alone in front of the net. The puck comes to him and he just wraps it around real quick. And then Blankenberg, for some reason, is down in front of the
He's
net.
crashing, yeah.
Yeah. And then he's able to bang it in. But that, again, this was like a much more sloppy game from Notre Dame. So.
Right. And so now it's 3-3, and you finally do get that goal that theoretically you're hoping came on the power play.
Yeah.
It didn't. And so now you're kind of back in it. And then they take a that's when this kind of gets a little bit weird, right? Like, so Beecher, so Michigan's got a little bit of jump, but Beecher comes into the zone and is like sort of riding a guy on the forecheck. Trying to take the puck away, bother him, force a turnover, and he gets called for a hook, but it kind of looks like his stick is held.
That's one of the oldest trick in the book.
Because when a
When
guy hooks you just grab it and you're like,
you
ah.
feel that stick come up, just kind of grab it real quick, and
So
it can
should
look
you,
like a hold from behind.
so do you just, is that part of it? You just don't even put your stick there? I mean, is that what you're taught? You're a
No, I
hockey
mean
coach.
you I mean guys do that. It's just,
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the hidden ball trick, right? Like occasionally it works. So.
So 5-on-4, and Notre Dame has a power play, and then we get the Holtz DQ
Situation.
hit behind the net, sort of, that was argued to not be a great call, and it's a 5-on-3 for Notre Dame. They end up getting a goofy goal off of it, a shot from the dot that.
Which they kill off the 5-on-3, and it's right
Right.
as Beecher's coming back onto the ice,
Right, and he
where
actually gets to the puck,
it's
I think.
another, it's exactly like the first Notre Dame goal, where they have a guy back checking back, he gets right there, obstructs the puck handler, and somehow the puck goes straight to a shooter.
Ellis
Just like,
on the dot, and Portillo gives it up short side, which is the
which was not
third
great.
goal from Portillo. You're kind of like, I think he's going to want this one back. So it's 4-3 after all of that. That's one of the worst things is, you giving up a power play goal happens, but giving up a power play goal after you've either just killed off one of them or before your guys can get off the ice is almost more deflating
Yeah,
in
which by
some
the way,
ways.
I mean, that Holtz penalty happened 16 seconds into the original penalty. And
Yeah.
this is what we have to talk about later, but like.
No, we can go now. This is the time. It's at the end of the third. It's 4-3. Yost is on fire because everyone is just booing like crazy, going nuts. And you were not so thrilled with this call and maybe even
I
the
have a
Beecher call.
half-written column about refereeing in hockey that may have to wait till another time because Ohio State Week is consuming my work right now. I couldn't finish it Saturday night because of various reasons, but I just kind of ran out of gas. Sometimes you're in a groove, but my savagery of the NCAA was in a groove, and then I didn't have time to really give the thoughts about the weekend that I would have
Do you want to
needed.
give us a
So,
couple little spoilers?
well, I mean, if it's never gets released, maybe I'll just save it till the next bad thing happens. But basically, my issue is with this 5-minute misconduct thing because. Michigan, I believe, is now up to 5 in 14 games,
So like one every other weekend.
which is very strange because this is not a physical team. They're now
Yeah,
second in
that's
penalty
true.
minutes in the entire country. And again, this is not the Broad Street Bullies of the 1970s. Like, we're not talking about a team. This is not Western Michigan. This is not a
Yeah.
team of 24-year-olds who weigh 215 pounds that are out there to hit you around. Like, I don't understand how this team is the one that we're cracking down on. And my issue with it too is two things. It's you hear this a little bit with the targeting thing in football, but the right now, in the way the rule is being enforced, the punishment is far worse than the crime. And that's the issue in most
Yeah.
cases, right?
Yeah.
I think the punishment was worthy of the crime when Noah Cates hit Blankenberg up high in that game back in Duluth.
Because that was like intentional.
I think it was worthy when Eugene Fadeev hit Dakota Raby into the boards in that ugly hit that started the brawl against Ohio State a few years back. Mm-hmm. This, you know, the fact is, this is not like, because even when we talk about with football, you know, unless the guy you're throwing out is Aiden Hutchinson, like, it's not that severe of a penalty, let's be frank. If it's like your second string safety or some defensive tackle, like, most of the guys that get hit with targeting, like, aren't important guys. Unless it happens to a really crucial player, you lose someone that's like a dude and that's it. And it's 15 yards, which, okay, that happens like often in a game.
It would be like if you lost that player for, you had to play with 10 players in football for the next drive or something.
Yeah, like, for the next drive with like 35 or 45 yards of penalty yardage with it. Like, a 5-minute major is a huge, I mean, it's double and a half what the normal penalty is. Like, that's 30, 40 yards of yardage.
That doesn't run out if you score. So you could score two or three goals.
It is like, plus kicking the player out, it should be reserved for Claude Lemieux on Chris Draper or, you know, Ulf Samuelson on Cam Neely, right? And insert your classic cheap shot of the past here. But not these situations where you have marginal hits that could go either way. And so, you know, I mean, I've always said that I cut referees a lot of slack for the calls they make in real time because of how difficult that job is. But when you have time to sit down and watch the tape, wait, there's no time limit. They don't get 1 minute when they step in the box. They could be there 45 minutes if they want it. Get the call right. And my issue is, you're cracking down on hits like the Holtz hit, where you have a guy who's already going down, you know, he gets bumped, but again, he's already falling. The player is not hit. The player is not injured. There is no intent to injure. That is not a thing we need to be doing that for. If you want to hit it with 2 minutes, I still don't like it given that situation because what it meant for 5-on-3 in that game instance, but okay. But deciding to behead for shoplifting is not the way we should be going here. And that's basically what that penalty is. And it's more infuriating when you consider that Garrett Van Wy gets knocked down to the ice, gets cross-checked in the back of the head on purpose, and that's not called. This rule is not defending players. It's subjecting us to a 3-minute horse and pony show where we decide whether the referees, who have no accountability, and because this is a sport that only a few weirdos care about, will never be questioned on it. And they decide whether a 20-year-old gets to play the game that they love for another 40 minutes or not. No explanation ever has to be given. And there's no rhyme or reason to what calls are disqualified and which are not. And when you're letting ones go that were intentionally to injure and penalizing ones that had no intent to injure, you're not protecting players. It's a sham.
No,
spare me the waxing poetic about how the NCAA cares about preventing cognitive damage and blah, blah, blah.
I don't think anyone's ever going to say that.
It's a joke.
But I mean, somebody will, but we won't listen to them.
So, you know, that's my problem here with that rule and the way it is.
And like what you're talking about is the punishment completely changes the game.
It's game-altering in a way that for football it is not, and for a lot of these other sports it is not. Like, it's far more game-altering than when they accidentally called a foul on Trey Burke with 6 minutes to go in a tie game. Like, that, in the grand scheme of things, has really no impact on this altered the game massively because it gave a team a 2-minute 5-on-3 and then 3 additional minutes of power play time.
And even if they threw Holtz out, but he didn't have a specific penalty for it, like, that would even be better.
Yeah.
Because, okay, the guy, you know, he took a hit that he didn't deserve to, which didn't seem to be in this case. But even if you deem that he did, all right, he's out of the game. But the team doesn't have to, like, kill off the next period. Well, 35 minutes for the power play. Yep, there you go. You know, like, well, how are you supposed to do that? It's what it is. Refereeing has been bad in college hockey.
About refereeing, you know, the adjacent part to it is the reality of this weekend, and this was more a thing about Friday night, but it was very much the same debate that NHL types are now having across the league about the situation with Connor McDavid, which is that some folks have been yelling about this for years, but the NHL is now only caring because attendance is down and suddenly the owners need to figure out why people aren't showing up. And one of the major things that are being suggested is that, as we've talked about many times over the years, the NHL, unlike the other leagues, goes out of its way to rig the rule book against its best players. And
which is so weird, because if any league needs their players to be like front and center and feature, it's the NHL.
Which, you look at the way the NBA has, you know, I don't know if it was always this way, I'm not a basketball historian, but definitely who gets the most fouls in the NBA? It's like James Harden every year, and he does it on purpose, and everyone knows it's a just a fraud, but they give it to him. He's a star, right? There are calls in basketball that, you know, are always, well, if that's LeBron, he gets the call. If it's KCP, he doesn't, right? Like, we know that because that's how it works. And football has completely neutered the way the game is played, you know, and by neutering a cornerback's ability to play the ball at all.
Right.
I mean, cornerbacking is impossible nowadays.
Yeah,
you throw
is.
The ball on, if you just intentionally underthrew the ball on deep balls and made sure the wide receiver put himself in position to get run over by the cornerback, who has no way to know the ball's underthrown, you get pass interference every time. And you're not allowed to touch the quarterback at all if it's 1 second after he threw the ball. Like, they have deliberately moved to make their quarterbacks the stars of the game. And it's worked out. Passing his way up, scoring, you know, is at a solid level for teams that have quarterbacks. The quarterbacks are the big stars. They're the names everyone knows in American sports. It's worked. The NHL and college hockey and everybody else has decided that if you rip down a guy with the puck who is not a very good player, you have a decent shot of getting penalized. But you can rip down Connor McDavid 15 times a game because he's that good. And if you don't do it, he's going to score on you. And it's fine, because calling more, if McDavid drew more penalties than Darren Helm, that would be unfair to Darren Helm. Like, that's the way they've gone about it. You know, when you go in this mindset that, well, each team needs to get three penalties each, and one team has a guy who's a lot better than all of the other players and
put together
has someone riding on their back the entire game, well, we can't call that because each team needs to get three penalties. So, sorry. And that's kind of their problem. McDavid in the playoffs played four games, all of which went to overtime, or three of the four went to overtime, and he drew one penalty in four games. Less than like several grinders on those two teams. And like, there is something wrong there. And so you have this weekend where, on Friday night in particular, Michigan, same thing happens. They've got the speedy, skilled players, and multiple times Notre Dame dudes just rip them down from behind. And there's no call because, well, you know, if we called that, then the team with the better players would win. And
what a concept.
And it's like, it's just, and then you end that Friday night game with Michigan getting one power play compared to the other team, which got three, including a 5-minute major. And you sit there and watch Michigan's players get dragged down from behind the entire game. And it's just tiring. It's just, this is what they want this to be. They want this to be a...
Well, they want to play in front of empty arenas of the games that matter the most too. So, I mean, it's not... That it's not overly surprising. I don't disagree with you or think that you're crazy or anything. I do. I just am. I don't know. Sometimes we wonder why we care about college hockey on a college hockey podcast, but we should finish up the third. I agree with what you're saying.
I will say in my column that is not published and may never will be, but I also just laid into the whole thing, right? It's not just the reviews, it's not just this, it's not everything, it's the fact you can't stream the games using watchable footage. Like, the NCAA routinely sabotages their product and then is surprised that it's a niche sport that only a few weirdos care about,
at least for one team. So they get into the third, it's 4-3 Notre Dame, and then Michigan gets all the chances in the world, it seems like, and nothing can go in. And you know, they get another power play, they get another 5-on-3. We don't need to talk about it again. I wrote down that we need to talk about this to make sure that we talked about it at some point. It was frustrating to watch. And then Bortolo has the puck kind of near the boards outside of the dot, throws it at Bischel, and he kind of like farts it into the net, and it's tied. And I think Stephen King like tweeted at me. He's like, "That's the goal we score after like all of these chances." And I was like, "I guess."
I have to make a graphic for my reactions to bad goals, but we were talking about this last week. But that's
do they include your faces?
That's definitely like an oh boy, just like where your initial thought is just I feel bad for the goalie because that is woof.
Beniers almost wins it later. He had a really good chance, but Bischel saved it and covered it. And then probably the one of the plays of the game was Truscott taking a shot from, I think it was the left point, the puck hitting something, going high in the air, perfectly.
It was going in the net.
arcing over Bischel, who's a little bit out to face the long shot to cut down the angle. And as it's angling down into the net, Lieberman, I think it was Lieberman, comes flying across and makes like a soccer goalie diving save to knock the puck out of the way.
Yeah. Well, he knocks it out of the air with his glove, which isn't technically a penalty, but you feel like it kind of should be.
Well,
it's only a penalty if you close your hand around it, but it was definitely just like, ha, phew,
and he knocked it down.
It
looked like a soccer goalie. And so it stays 4-4, and of course the game goes to overtime. And I mean, so again, we debated on how to do this or how not to. Michigan had a shot that goes wide. Bortolo was on the ice for a long time. You see, that's the thing in these situations is when you're trying to control the puck the whole time and you're just skating around the offensive zone because you're trying not to give it away and you only want to take a good shot, eventually you run out of gas because, you know, it's on you. So there's a lot of zone entries and exits and entries and exits. And Bortolo, I think, then got frustrated and threw one at the net or gave it away. And all of a sudden there's a rush the other way. Portillo made a nice little save. But then I think you mentioned in our prep, or if you listened to the late segment, that maybe Brisson got dragged a little bit into the corner. Michigan had two guys stuck there.
He decided to do a do or die play and then he died. That's the best way to put it.
The puck gets centered, I guess, apparently for a 2-on-1. And it's a pretty easy goal at the end because you use up the defender and someone's alone in front and Portillo doesn't have a chance. And it's over and Notre Dame gets the second point again. And I mean, yeah, it's a breakdown. It's, you know, we talked about a number of things that we didn't like, some of the calls, and Portillo had a bad game. But the reality is that sort of across the board, Michigan just didn't play well enough. They didn't hold a lead again. Their goalie had probably his worst game of the year, and they couldn't finish their number of really good chances in the third. And, you know, you leave it up to Notre Dame in overtime and look back through history. Michigan doesn't have a great history against Notre Dame in overtime, even going back to Denver in 08. So
it's, I mean, the last thing I'll point out, I just remembered this, but Michigan played this game kind of like they were, like the Soviet Red Army team of the mid 70s, like at its peak, where they're just trying to be genius. And so, especially in the offensive zone, they love to do behind the back drop passes and stuff for the guy. And that's all stuff you can practice and get drilled down. But in this game, you would have power at the point, and then he'd leave the puck behind him for someone he thinks is going to be there. And then the Notre Dame players, who did a really good job taking away space and time in this game, boom, the Notre Dame guy would be right there and would take it away. And that was leading to breakaways and stuff. And they're trying to play like they all are, you know, Datsuk brain, and they don't all have Datsuk brain. And sometimes they just got a little too cute against a team that was definitely, again, taking away time and space.
Someone was asking me about this series, and I just kind of summed it up with right now, and this could change, but right now, Michigan has way more talent and skill than Notre Dame, and Notre Dame's a better team.
In terms of team, yes.
Yes. That's what I mean. When you're talking about a hockey team, who has a better hockey team? Notre Dame does. Michigan has higher upsides for almost one through whatever their players. If you stack them up, you're going to take the Michigan guy, number one, number two, number three, over the Notre Dame guy. But they don't play as well together as Notre Dame does. And they don't do the things that Notre Dame does well to give them those chances. They out-talent you and they have their NHL goals and their or NHL saves and those individual plays. They're a little bit like an all-star team at times.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I think that like What's frustrating is we talk about this with the team, that Mel Pearson's teams get better as the year goes along, that they improve they do, in the second half, that they make the adjustments. But the frustrating thing is that, like, you wanted this to be a year when you bring everybody back that you don't have the coaching staff incapacitated for the start of the season. And
the guys know what to do already.
You hoped that it's kind of the Brandon Johns thing, right? That you hoped that when they make progress in the spring, that we're starting from that point of progress in the fall and not like where we were 2 years ago or something. Right. And that's kind of the frustrating part.
And if it was Hughes and Mackey and Duke, you're kind of like, well, yeah, there's going to be some jumps at some point. But you were hoping that it wasn't going to be the mistakes from Power and the mistakes from Brisson or Bordalo or guys like that. Because
Jared Van Wy.
Well, there you go. But it's frustrating. They're not a bad team. And the frustration from us is not that they still haven't won a bunch of games, or they're still not leading the Big Ten, or, you know, all those things, because those are all remotely true or true. The problem is that we're grading against what this team could and should be, because you look at we may never see a team like this again. And you want to accomplish something phenomenal, numbers of some things, when you have the chance to do it. And right now they're playing better than any team Michigan team has in the first half in the last 4 or 5 years. But there's a lot of things that they could still be doing a lot better that you would have hoped would not still be a problem.
Well, and I think the other thing about all of this too, that's important to sort of talk about, is, you know, because they're a better team than they have been in the past, talent wise, they can still get, what I'm trying to say is that in the past, this sort of start to a season in terms of the fundamentals and everything would have like put them in a really bad spot where Right. We would be in that needing to win everything. Whereas they can probably talent themselves to get to Christmas, where then they're going into the new year and they're still first in the Big Ten, despite not playing very well, because they're just a lot better than all of the other teams. And that's
right.
So that's kind of the thing, is like they're 10-2-2, 10-4, but 10-2-2 for pairwise purposes.
Right.
And so everyone's like, well, what's the problem? And it's like, well, there isn't really a problem, because their goal differential is still like +24 and blah, 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 blah. It doesn't show up on the record, but there are things that need to improve. And plus you can get performances like what we're starting to see from Samo, right? Where those kinds of players can come on in the second half. And so there's still a lot of potential, but they're going to need to improve. And it's frustrating that they aren't better from a fundamental standpoint.
That's the main thing there, is that you wish that the things that you should be able to assume about players at this skill level and who've been playing together for well over a year now, because this team is very much the same as it was last year, if not even better in terms of adding
what I want to see this team get to is not sort of kind of the way they're playing it in terms of just like all out fire wagon hockey. Like, okay, I can see why you want to try and do that given how much talent you have. But what I want to see this team do, honestly, is I want to see this team be the 2008 Red Wings, which are, I think, the best Red Wing team of that era. Also the best analytics team of the analytics era by all of the metrics. And what was the hallmark of the 08 Red Wings? They just smothered you, not in a trapping way. It's like they got 33 shots, you got 18 shots, and two of your 18 shots were high danger. Like you just were choked from the game because they dominated puck possession in all phases and stamped out, chances by just controlling play. That's what this Michigan team has the talent to do. That's what they should be doing. They should not be trading odd man rushes and stuff and just kind of out there like it's pickup basketball and they're pulling up from 30 feet with 27 on the shot clock, right? It's like, if this team plays the fundamentals and they are well coached, they should be able to just
destroy people. And that's sort of the frustration point is, you know, all the goals are still on the table. We're not talking about that. Goals.
Yeah.
Team goals are still on the table. It's just that there is a level of potential of game to game watching this team that can happen with them that I'm not sure I've ever really seen a team in college that was capable of doing it, and this team can. And that's why we're a little frustrated. That's why fans are frustrated. And there's reason to that. But you can't get too down on them either, because they are still putting up good results. It's just
the sky is not falling.
No, it's just that we're Michigan fans and we have to complain about something, right?
There you go.
So Michigan plays Niagara this weekend. I assume both games are on ESPN. ESPN. Yep. BTN Plus. Niagara is not good. They're 52nd in pairwise, 48th in Corsi. Their power play is at 13%. Their penalty kills at 75%. Wow. They have no drafted skaters. No one is scoring at 0.75 points per game or higher. Their team GAA is 3.68, and their team save percentage is 0.877. So there's not really a part on the ice that you're looking at and saying, this is a worry. Michigan, I mean, they there's, depending on how motivated they are for this weekend, they could win both these games 10-1.
Niagara has two wins this season in 10 games. One of them is a one goal win over Air Force. The other one is a three goal win over Sacred Heart. So they have one win in 10 games against a team, or by a margin of more than a single goal. They've played two power conference teams, NoDak and Penn State. They lost both of those series on aggregate 10-2, and Michigan beat Penn State very handily.
Yep. So it's, they could use a weekend like this.
This
it's
is the not, weekend, if there ever was one, to see a backup goalie.
Yeah, and that probably wouldn't be a bad idea. I mean, dude transferred here anyway. Give him a game, maybe two.
Yeah. You could give West one period and then, Levy another period.
You could, in theory, hopefully. So it's a longer podcast. Stick around if you want to hear our secret segment that we kind of planned but didn't, and talked about a lot of other things and also a little bit hockey. It should be interesting. Let us know what you think. Maybe we'll do it again.
For listening to Michigan HockeyCast 4.8 for Alex Dreen and David Nasternak. Why did I do both the intro and the outro this week? Well, David, I'm coming for your job.
You have the editing privileges, so you can cut out whatever you want.
I'm the tyrant here. Ryan, oh, come on, watch out.
You've been dreaming about this for since you were probably 3 years old. Were you the kid that built all the Lego statues and the forts, but instead of it being some sort of evenly based war, it was just destroying certain things? You'll never get in here, and then the peasants are all murdered.
Not really. I'm not really sure about that situation. I was a major player in the Emerson School Ice Wars of 2009. That's all I have to say.
I don't know that anyone really knows what that is, but you are.
Some folks remember. Us veterans with the battle scars remember.
So you were saying that you're really mad at everyone who isn't. Portillo?
I said I came away from the second game less angry about everyone that isn't Portillo, referees, and Luck.
Okay, so you're mad at Luck, you're mad at Portillo, and you're mad at referees?
Because the five goals, the first one, they actually get back, and it's I don't remember if it was Moyle or Morgan or Pasichov actually back check hard, tying up the guy with the puck, and it just bounces right to another guy.
It does, and then Portillo
doesn't, and then Portillo doesn't get the pad down. So right. That's both luck and Portillo. Second goal is just luck. I mean, the puck goes right to a guy with a yawning cage. Like,
yeah, that's the shot from the point that goes to the left side. Yeah, that one I wasn't really worried about.
The third one is Portillo just, I mean, I sent you the screenshot. I mean,
well, if he, got, the dumb thing is if he plays it backwards, he's fine.
Yeah, it's hard for him to know to play backwards if he hasn't scanned, though. What you need to do there is either just hightail it back to the net, I think, or get to that puck quicker, which is what I would have recommended, right? That was like, we've talked about this. That was something that Martin Brodeur really used when he played the puck a lot, is that he was a really, really good skater for a goalie. Yeah. How quickly you can get there really matters, so you're not in that situation.
Is he allowed to freeze at that point? Like, could he drop and cover it?
I don't think so.
So what would that be? A delay?
I have to look at the rule book.
So the interesting thing about that is there were multiple times this weekend and plenty of other times as we're getting used to with Portillo, but where he's anywhere on the ice with the puck and someone is trying to trap him and he looks at the guy and just says, I'm going to pass to my open teammate, and does. Yet in this situation, he's like, can only throw forward. Oh no, player, turnover. Like, he could have turned, like you were saying, like he could have turned and someone who's too blurry is sitting in front of the net. Someone on the other side is there wide open too. And that's something that if he wasn't behind the net already facing a certain direction, he might have just been like, oh, nope, you're covered. Okay, check down. I'll pass to you.
Yeah. I mean,
anyway, that's
those,
the third
those kind of plays are the ones, like a lot like the Talia pick six to DJ Turner, like those kinds of quarterback well, plays where you watch it happening and you're just like, oh no. And then it happens, right? Like the quarterback is on the run and is just going to heave it. Or like in this case, Portillo coming out and there's a dude bearing in on him. And like, you're like, oh no. And it happens exactly as you see coming.
But that was a nice play by DJ, I thought.
Well, yeah, but that ball can't go
like hover. Like that. Okay. So that's the third goal. The fourth goal.
The fourth goal is just like, I won't. Okay. It's messed up by the ref. It's the five right after the 5-on-3 ends. It's basically just the result of that call on Steve Holt.
But doesn't it go in short side?
Yes. It's not good from Portillo, which is again what I said.
Yeah.
But from a team standpoint, it's like for all of the other players, it's the result of just getting screwed by a bad call and then your goalie not picking you up.
Can we just get mad at all the players for even putting the referee in any sort of a position where he can ever make a call? Like, just don't play hockey, just skate around. And, you know,
Al Randall was getting violent on the broadcast.
You've sat near Al Randall.
I sat near Al Randall for 4 years.
I can't imagine him being violent.
He's like, actually a nice guy in all of my.
No, I think so too. And one time when I was listening to a game back in like 2012 when I didn't live here, I wrote in, like, they were like, send us an email from where you're from or where you're listening from. And that's not my Al Randall voice. But so I did. I was from like St. Simons Island, Georgia. And I was like, there's no way that they've ever gotten an email from here before. And he read it on the air. And I was hey, I made it.
Yeah, he's just can be a little blaha sometimes when it comes to refereeing.
That's not being boring. That's being George, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the OT winner, one that I think, like,
they had two guys in the corner, but still, like,
it's watching that play, I think it's on Brisson. You have the shot that comes in. Hughes is late to pick it up, but that's not what causes it. Brisson has an opportunity to either pinch down and try to just muzzle the play there or fall back and just guard his man. And he goes for the do or die play on the wall. He dies. And then it's a 2-on-1 for an easy tip in. That puck, when he goes against the wall, that puck cannot come out of there. You've got to stop it or else you're dead. And they were dead.
It's also like 3-on-3 where I get to the point where when you look at those sort of situations where you're like, all right, someone's going to do something good to make a goal or someone is going to do something bad to allow a goal. But in 3-on-3, I don't know. I mean, how much of that are you really counting? Like, it's so weird. It's so different than normal. Like, yeah, don't break down and do something dumb. I get that. But at the same time, like, a goal is probably going to be scored. Because
it just hurts
to lose happen
twice in 3-on-3 to these dudes when you are the team that should win every 3-on-3 game.
But what does that tell you the problem is?
We'll leave that for the show.
The show's over. If people are listening to this, it's after they've already listened to everything. In fact, they're probably going to be mad we even put this on there, because they'll be like, oh, you guys already talked about all this. When does the good juicy stuff come out about how Alex doesn't own anything but tank tops? That's what I'm listening to this to find out.
All right, Patrick, if you're listening to this, that right there was the time to cut the secret segment.
How many curls can Alex do? I want to know. How many curls can you do?
We're not going to discuss that.
We're not going to discuss it. See, what you should say is, like, you know, 55, and then I'll be like, wow, that's a lot. And you'll be like, don't ask me what weight it is. Anyway.
All right. Time to start the real show.
No. We're talking about, I want it, because we're not going to have time to do this later, but, like, so you watched all these Ohio State games. Yeah. By choice. Like, Brian and Seth didn't say, hey, before you do FFFF, please go back and review the last few Ohio State games so that you have some context. You were like, my own free will says highlights of 2 years ago.
Okay, so I refused to watch the 2016 Ohio State game.
Rewatch?
Yes.
Oh, I will never watch that. Yeah, I agree with you. That won't happen. No, he had it on and I yelled at him. You won't rewatch that. I agree with you.
Because that one, and I also haven't rewatched 17 either, because those are two that, like, we tangibly could have won had just a few things gone differently. 2019 are still too far away, and that, like, a lot of things would have had to go differently. But there's enough there for it to still be like, ah!
So what positive are you expecting to get out of this? What nugget of anything are you going to be like, if I get this, this
well, to some extent, it does help in terms of comparing those offenses to the one
2018
one I'm doing for not Michigan, Ohio State
for Ohio State.
FFFF, just schematically.
Yeah, because Stroud is more Haskins than Barrett, I would say.
Well, not many quarterbacks are JT.
Well, but JT was like great runner and decision maker.
Yeah, I know that's what I mean.
But if you make him throw, I mean,
there have not been many runners that were as like bowling ball and always finding the right hole as him.
No, he also but if you could control their line of scrimmage, he was also not a threat to throw a pass.
Yeah. By the way, I think there's some revisionist history about that 2017 Ohio State team.
Okay.
Because I was listening to the main pod today while I was at the gym, and like
good employees do.
And I think that people don't remember how good that Ohio State team was. Like
2017?
I sent you the SP Plus numbers. The gap there was much, much wider than it is even in this game. Like, no one thought Michigan had a shot to be on that field.
Is that the one they were two? Game.
What?
Is that the one they were number two?
The season or the...
No, their SP Plus number was number two.
Yes, I believe, yeah. And they didn't make the playoff because of the Iowa game. Because
I think Michigan
was... And they
lost
to Oklahoma, but Oklahoma was really good that year.
Because I think the thing that I took away from that was that Michigan, that was their down year, right? Like, they were 13th.
Yes, Michigan was
not very
good.
I like how they lost five games and they're still 13th.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a quarterback or a line.
Yeah, the gap was 10.3. The gap this time is 8, which is still wide, but it's not as wide as that one. No one thought Michigan had a chance to be on the field, and they were on the field for a long time. Like,
because John O'Connor didn't implode until the end.
If Michigan, but here's the thing about that game, of course, is that that is like the best game plan of Jim Harbaugh's entire career at Michigan.
Well, involved Chris Evans in space, so.